Hi, my name is Katrina Nguyen. It is September 27th, 2017. We are in South Stevens Hall, the University of Maine. Barbara Stevens, Elizabeth Stevens, excuse me, is going to be doing the conducting this interview with Norman, Jordan, and Leonard. We are hoping to discuss the Jewish population of Bangor and their history. And then I'm going to ask each of you to introduce yourselves, your name, your date of birth, and what's your, just very, very briefly, connection to this topic. And then we can move on to the actual interview. And then, of course, anytime you want to pause.
Okay, I'm the first in the row here, but my name is Norman Minsky. My date of birth is May 25, 1930. And I'm here, I guess, principally because I'm old and have a good memory. And that's the combination, I guess, you want. My brother is older and has a good memory, so he's next in line.
I'm Leonard Minsky. I was born in 1927, and I'm here because my brother said I should be here.
I'm Jordan Alpert. I was born July 20th, 1953, in Bangor, Maine. I am a family historian of the Alpert and Cohen family of Bangor, Maine. And that's probably the principal reason for my being here.
I'm Elizabeth Stevens. I'm participating as an interviewer because I've been processing a lot of archival collections that have to do with the Jewish community of Bangor, Maine.
And then also present, though probably not talking, introduce yourself to you, please.
I'm Debbie Alpert, and Jordan is my husband. I'm here to listen.
Too hot, I'm
going to
open the door.
Well, I don't know who wants to jump in first, but I'm guessing it might be.
Oh, I think my older brother knows more about it.
Okay, then I'll ask you, Leonard, first. What do you know about the lives of your ancestors in the old country, where they came from before they came here? The United States.
I know very, very little, and other than the area in which they came from,
okay.
And a little bit about the lifestyle, which was very, very common to the Jewish communities and the shtetls of. He came from a Vilnius Gemara, which I guess translates to the county of Vilnius. The community, as I understand it, was Russian one day and Polish the next, whoever won the last battle. And he was one of 9 or 10 children, most of whom emigrated to this country.
You know, I can fill in a little more. Our grandfather's name was Hillel, and his wife's name was Leah, and the town was, if you want a transliteration, I believe it was Kreva, K-R-E-V-A.
Yeah, I thought of that.
And the stories that my father told was, at least his grandfather was ordained. He did not know whether his father had been or not. He did tell the stories, Leonard, you can correct me, because I may have these wrong, that they had some kind of a little store which didn't do much. There was a chicken coop, or refined chicken coop behind the house where the grandfather lived. His father basically stayed in the store, but when a customer came studying, because what they did all day long was study the good books. And when a customer came, he would bang on the table so his wife could come in and wait on anybody. And he and his father had very significant shouting matches, but always over the interpretation of one of the books. And he did tell us the story that apparently every Friday his mother went down to the local grist mill and put a sack of flour on her back, which she didn't pay for, she charged. And she came back and made white bread, and they sold the white bread on Sunday to the Christians who came into the Orthodox Church. On Monday she paid for the, this is as I remember it, paid for the flour from 2 weeks ago, but didn't pay for the current bread because they never had enough money and they were never out of debt because it was always at least 1 week behind. I don't know if you remember those. those stories or not.
Yeah, the other story that I remember is, at least your father told, is that your grandmother, or his mother, took great pride in the fact that she could run the store so that her husband could be the town educator, if you will, and she took great pride in the fact that her husband was the man that they came to study with.
Thank you, Norm and Leonard. And
the other story I remember them saying is that, because they were very poor, and that for the Sabbath, they put white sand on the floor because it made it look better. And he also, the only education he had was religious education, and he went away 1 year to a distant town, like 20, 25 miles, and the little yeshivas that they were called basically were one room, might be in a cellar, and you slept on a bench as well as you studied there. And since Judaism stresses education, it was the obligation of relatives in that town to feed any student. And see, Joel was nodding his head. So he went each day to a different relative, and he said Tuesday was his favorite day because that day he got meat, because that was the richest relative, and they saved a piece of meat which they may have had on Saturday.
Thank you, Norman. Jordan, do you want to talk about
your opinion?
Sure.
The oldest known ancestor in our family, his name was Reuven Alperovich, lived in the same province that Leonard's and Norman's ancestors came from, which was in the Vilna province. And he lived in a very, very small town called Sasinka, and that town is now in Belarus. And over time, considering it was near the border of what was at that time called White Russia or Belarusia, with the advances and declines of the Russian Empire, it went back and forth, as Leonard indicated, depending upon who was in control at what time. Right now, Belarus is in control, so that little village is within the country of Belarus, but at that time it was within Lithuania. So this oldest ancestor of mine was a lumber man, and he had a big family, and at least two of his sons were also lumbermen, and one of his sons-in-law was also a lumberman, or two of them, pardon me, and one of his son-in-laws was my great-grandfather, whose name was Moshe Alperovich. He was engaged in the lumber industry, and his son, who was my grandfather, was the first member of our family, our extended family, actually our branch of that family, let me correct myself, to come to Bangor. His two uncles had come here prior to that, both of them in the 1880s. And both of them changed their names from Alperovich to Cohen. My grandfather did not, and therefore they were Alperts and the others are Cohens. But their lives in this little village, I can't say that I know all that much about it, except to say that when the first of our ancestors came here, it was around 1881, and it was probably no coincidence that at that time the Tsar had enacted what were called the May Laws, and these were a group of laws. There were actually two sets of May Laws that were promulgated. And these laws included all kinds of restrictions on the Jewish people, where they could live, when they could move, what kind of businesses they could engage in, whether they could own land, which actually they couldn't. They were forced out of agriculture, not allowed to enter public schools. There were all kinds of today unimaginable decrees. So those who could start leaving left. So the first one who came here was, I think, among the group of 10,000 people that were allowed to leave the country legally, the country meaning part of the Russian Empire, and he came to Maine. So that's a little bit of what I can tell you. And Leonard, you wanted to
aside from those laws, or within those laws, but at least according to my father, was the most onerous of them all, and that was the Russian draft of the army.
Yeah.
And that was like a death sentence.
That's right.
For a Jew, it was.
Particularly for a Jew. That was like a death sentence. So, quite frankly, for you to know what your grandparents' last name was, it is great, because according to my father, it was not unusual for a family to change their last name, because if the other guy's name was on the draft list, then he might have been a Mitskoon, he might have been a Minsky, and he might have been something else next time. But that was certainly one of the major factors, yes. Aside from all of the other onerous things that you just mentioned.
After World War II, when I was looking for remnants, my father, he mentioned Mitskoon. How you spell that, I don't know, but that was one of the names he looked for survivors. Another, as I recall, was Abramson, I think he said he looked. And there may have been other names. As far as some of the town in which my father grew up, there was a man named Julius Aborn, and he wrote a history of his family with a great deal of research into Kreva. And he came to visit us in the late 40s and gave us a copy of the book. It does mention Hillel. There's a copy of that book in the Bangor Library in the book in that Minsky box. Just a little aside was, Leonard and I were probably the proud owners of maybe the first two ballpoint pens in Bangor. Right after the war, he went into the manufacturer of ballpoint pens, with knowing what they were, and when he came to Bangor, he brought each of us one.
Interesting. I just want to add one sidebar to what Leonard was talking about in terms of the draft. There had been, over time, prior to the May laws, various programs to conscript people into the Russian army. And why it was so negative for Jews was, first and foremost, that Jewish young men were subjected to all kinds of pressure to convert. And that was first and foremost the biggest problem. So the idea was, first of all, the Russian program in general was to get the Jewish people to stop practicing their religion and become members of the Orthodox Church, and to Russify them is the term. And so the one czar after another had various programs trying to accomplish this goal. And the idea is, if you're in the army, you had no choice but to eat what they fed you. What were they going to force you to eat? Pork. Well, pork is not kosher. So you're talking about asking somebody who was a vegetarian all of a sudden to start, you know, eating a beef. Actually, even worse than that, because their vegetarian diet is usually, not always, but usually not based on religion. It's based on, you know, ethical choices or health reasons or this or that. Or if it is based on religion, it's a complete contradiction. So they would do that and pull all kinds of other, or enact all kinds of other things to try to get them to convert. In the term of service, at the time of Tsar Nicholas, I believe it was, Nicholas I, it was a 25-year stint in the army. Now, it's hard to believe, but being drafted and having to spend 25 years in the army is pretty tough.
And also my father indicated that, as well as the fact that in many respects, because they were Jews and not considered Russian, they were virtually slave laborers in the army.
That's absolutely right. They had no opportunity for promotion. They were discriminated against. I mean, if they at least were there on a level playing field and so forth and so on, maybe, you know, it wouldn't have been so bad. I do, by the way, interestingly enough, had a great-grandfather on my mother's side who was a career army man in the Russian army. We're talking about somebody probably maybe born in the 1850s or something like that, and he must have been a rare bird to have endured that.
To have survived.
To have survived that, absolutely. So, there were a handful. But anyway.
From a family point of view, we mentioned where the Minsky may have come from, but most of our family that's in this city of Bangor is from my mother's side, my grandmother's side of the family.
Right.
That's the Epstein family.
And I think I mentioned before we started recording, that the Cohn Alpert family, Epstein family, were the two dominant families in the community.
In terms of size.
Huh?
In terms of
size. Yeah. They were in more than size. I would say for the first 75 years of Beth Israel, at least 35 or 40, the president was either an Epstein or Joe Ornstein, who was married to an Epstein. So they were prominent. But there must have been, I mean, there were half a dozen of them, and each had a dozen kids. If there were six or seven Epsteins or 10 Epsteins left, it's surprising. But I'm sure there had to be 100 or more in the Cohn Alpert family.
Oh, very, very large. I mean, I have not done a count, but I can say this, that my grandfather had a minimum of 40 first cousins, minimum. And there were a whole bunch of cousins I could never even be able to identify. So if
because
he had 40,
they had 10 or 12 children.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you get five or six brothers, each with 10 or 12 children, you end up with a rather large family.
Yeah, I don't even have a count of his nieces, nephews, and first cousins once removed. I mean, if you add all of it up, it's significant. And the Epstein, having seen, you know, that enormous family tree that you have, I mean, it's a staggering number of people. So in terms of just sheer quantity between these two families, it probably, they no doubt must have been the largest.
Interestingly enough, in that family tree that Norman did, the next generations, Other than the Caymans or the Caymacovices, who had, I don't know, eight or nine kids, everyone else took up the American style, I guess, and had two or three. Because our family, you know, from that point of view.
Yeah, my grandfather too. He had three children.
So. Yeah, they came from 10 or 11 kids, but outside of the Caymacovices, which became Caymans.
Because even in American history, I think there was a tendency to have a lot of kids because you. One, they were
mortality rate was high.
Number one,
well, they were labor.
A number would die.
Yeah, mortality rate was high.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all. Why do you think your ancestors came to Bangor, Maine? Do you have any ideas about that? Did your parents tell you? Leonard, you want to say?
No, I was going to say that maybe you know more about how your family came here. I certainly have no idea why the first or the Epsteins came here. I can only surmise that they were peddlers, and when they got to Bangor, that was the end of the line.
Well, it really wasn't because we had peddlers from Fort Kent and Prescott.
Well,
I mean, for
the Epsteins.
But the Epsteins, yes. And why the first one came, I don't know. But
Norman,
is
it possible that Chaim Epstein was the first one to come here? No, okay.
No. When he came, because they had absolute poverty, and he came and he went to Boston, and he had a brother in Boston. His brother never succeeded financially, and I believe he worked for the city in public works.
You're talking about your uncle in Boston?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he worked for the city.
Yeah, he was remained very poor, but he had six or seven children.
Yeah.
And my father said, I got there, I looked around and said, this is as bad as Europe. But he had cousins and several uncles in Bangor. Why, I don't know. But you've got to recognize that in the turn of the previous century, Bangor and Maine was far more mainstream than it is today. Maine was an important state. Maine was a popular state. Maine was East Coast state. There was still some lumber work, so obviously it was fertile for a lot of them.
And I think some of them went in the dry goods business, and some of them, even when I was on Exchange Street, well, cause I got there before you did. there were Polish woodsmen that came out of the woods. And they would leave their money with two or three of the Jewish dry goods dealers on Exchange Street. So I don't know whether that. So back in the, oh my God, that was a lumber capital in those days.
No, they would get drunk and afraid they'd spend it all. So they'd say, hold $100 for me.
Yeah, Lewis also
or whatever they
kept
had,
the whole thing.
And that was common.
But I will tell you one story.
One of the things Jordan alluded to, the dry good business, the tailoring, the shoes. Jews were not permitted to own land, so there were no Jewish farmers virtually. J- Jews were not permitted to join guilds, which was the artisan associations. Therefore, they could not have most of the skills. So therefore, they became peddlers, they became shoe cobblers, and they became tailors. So when they came to this country, the New York garment industry was a bunch of Jewish immigrants. When they came here, they peddled clothing. Now, as they did better and better and better, they established little clothing stores. But and in Europe, quite frankly, they became money lenders. They get those few that had it. In Poland, they were in a very unenviable position. Part of the Polish anti-Semitism was that the Jews became the collectors for the peasants, and a Christian peasant had to be tossed out of his house if it was a Jew did it. The Jew didn't do it because he wanted to do it. The only way he got a living was to be the enforcer for the Polish nobility. And the Polish nobility was one that said you pay up or you push them out. So that was a story. But the idea of clothing, shoes, and look at Bangor. You had a half a dozen shoe factories in Bangor, and I think they were all Jewish owned. I mean, at least a half a dozen. You had ample knitting, and then you had other little manufacturer stores and little and peddlers. And they started out peddling. And it was difficult. David Cutler tells a story that his grandfather walked from Old Town to Bangor to get his goods and then took the car and walked back to Old Town to peddle in the Old Town area. And one of the things they had a little, I mean, who was going to loan money to these people? So they had a little, very little fund in the synagogue. And when you came, they'd give you $3 or $4, which was enough to fill up a cart. And when you got the money, you paid it back so they could use it on the next immigrant that showed up.
Well, this is just an anecdote, nothing to do with history. When my father arrived in Boston, there had been, he was going to meet at the railroad station his brother, the one that worked for the city of Boston. And there was some kind of a signal. And my father was among the youngest of the kids. He didn't know, he had never met his brother in Boston. So his brother in Boston convinced the downstairs neighbor, you know, those three-decker Boston houses, to go meet my father. So whatever the signal was, I have no idea, nor does my father remember. But he saw the signal, so he jumps on this guy, he hugs him, and he's kissing him, and the guy in English is saying, "I'm not your brother, I'm not your brother." And my father didn't understand what he was saying in the first place. It took him a long time before my father realized that that was the neighbor.
It's such a strange place. We had a stepmother, because our mother died. One of the stories she told was when she immigrated into Ellis Island, her father was to meet her, and he was late. But the family that she was with had to leave, so she was left alone. And she was crying and bawling, and, you know, 8 or 9 year old girl by herself in the middle of this horde at Ellis Island. And a very kindly, very fat black lady tried to console her. And she said, the more she tried to console me, the more frightened I got. One, she was so enormously fat, I'd never seen anyone like that, but she had never seen or heard of a black and couldn't understand a lady being black, so she got more. Then eventually her father showed up.
Thank you. I think, Jordan, you wanted to.
I'll answer briefly. And in terms of your question was, what, just to refresh my memory?
Why they chose to come to
Bangor. Oh, okay, yeah. Well, the earliest of our ancestors to come here, his father, as I mentioned, was a lumberman, and at least two of his siblings were in the lumber business. And my belief is that when he did not emigrate through New York, by the way, he came in through Boston, and he may have heard something about the lumber, the strength of the lumber industry in Bangor. Bangor at that time, we're talking about around 1881, yeah. 1882, was still in a tremendous lumber shipping port and a processing center. There were there were at least 100 sawmills. I mean, it the amount of lumber that was loaded onto ships and so forth on the Penobscot River was just immense. And the number of board feet of lumber processed in Bangor was, at that time, I couldn't say, but it was probably, it was in the hundreds of millions of what they measured as called board feet. And he probably came up here thinking, well, I can get a job in the lumber business. Of course, he didn't speak a word of English. And this is another thing. When these people came over here, they didn't speak, some of them might have spoken Russian. I know my grandfather spoke Russian fluently, and he spoke Yiddish, which was the tongue that, that the Jewish people of Eastern Europe all spoke. And he became fluent in English. But in the meantime, when he first came here, you know, he, what did he do? And what did his uncle do, which is my great uncle did? They became peddlers. And interestingly, the death certificate of Nathan Cohen, who was Nathan Alperovich, who became Nathan Cohen, lists his occupation as commercial traveler. Doesn't say peddler, it says commercial traveler. And also, looking at the inventory that is attached to his will that's on file in the probate court, it is an inventory of somebody who was out with probably a horse and wagon with goods such as caps and mittens and this many pair of dungarees and that many pairs of shoes and vests and so forth and so on. His whole inventory maybe was $300 or $350. But that's what they did. So they did what they could do to make a living. So that was what he started by doing, and probably ended by doing as well. But his children, of course, entirely different situation.
When my father came to Bangor, his first job was he cut ice on the Penobscot River, but his second job, he worked in a lumber mill.
I think he learned what it later became, I'm not sure of this, but was Stearns in Hamden.
It was.
And it was in that lumber mill that my father started the first Zionist organization in Bangor. He was sort of Mr. Zionism for 70 years in this town, and that's where he started his first group.
Right.
The history of that group is very interesting because it started out and sort of morphed into something other than a purely Zionist group. That's a different story, but it became Sons of Daughters of Zion, which became the primary social organization within the community. And there are pictures in the library, two pictures of around 1920 of the Sons and Daughters of Zion.
One anecdote I'm going to share, only because I heard this last night from a relative that I'd never met. I met him on the telephone, and he was telling me about his grandfather's background. His grandfather was an Alpert. And I know his grandfather and my grandfather initially roomed together in Bangor. My grandfather came here around 1902, it came to the United States around 1902 or something like that. He spent the first 2 years in New York going to night school and working in the garment district, and he went to night school so he could become fluent in English. He knew that if you did not know the language, you were not going to be able to ever navigate, you know, never progress, so forth and so on. But other cousin apparently came directly to Bangor. His name was Edward Alpert, and he was working, first he worked as a peddler, and then he worked as a tailor. And ultimately, he was employed by the Rockefeller family, which of course lived out in Mount Desert Island during the summer, and he was a tailor on their staff of tailors for the Rockefeller family. Well, he didn't feel like he was being treated very well by one of them, apparently, and so he decided to sew all the buttons on the suit that he was working on, that so that when the person who was going to put the suit on tried to button it up, all the buttons would fall off. So, of course, this did happen, and he was fired. So after he was fired, he said, that's it, I'm leaving Bangor. He left Bangor, and he went to Detroit, and he went back into, the junk business, but he ended up making a fortune in scrap metal. So it's a good thing he didn't stay in tailoring. That's about all I can say.
But you see, it all goes back to you become tailors, you become shoe cobblers, you go into the junk business because you could go around the countryside and just ask for the junk. Anything that didn't require skills except for the couple of ones that had been open to the Jews.
Right.
Junk dealers were very common.
Yes.
Well, the Stryers had a shoddy mill that was buying old cotton and weaving it into the new.
It was a recycling business, basically.
That's what it was. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. They collected old sweaters and old clothes. They weren't thrown away. They collected
right.
it and they reprocessed it, and it was this process called shoddy.
Yeah.
That was made into blankets and things like that.
Right.
That's up on Ayers Island.
Thank you all so much to it.
I think their biggest factory was in Corinna.
In Corinna, yeah.
Have any of you ever been in contact with people that you're related to from, I would guess, from the old country, from Vilna?
Well, I have been in contact with many of their descendants, and as far as somebody who was actually born there, I'm not sure that I have, because they left such, you know, such a long time ago. The latter ones to leave left 1909, 1910, something like that, and they were already, you know, teenagers or 18 years old or something like that. Therefore, the gap in age would have, you know, made that pretty unlikely. But as far as the next generation is concerned, yes, many, and that's where my information.
Just to toss it in the Bangor Library and my other places, is the book that Jordan wrote, which will cover generations of the Alpert Cohen family, and very inclusive. I don't think he missed anybody.
I probably did.
And the library has a basically a family tree of the Epstein side, of but no stories.
Should I tell the story about Bunkies and my father's sales?
Oh, absolutely, because I was thinking about mentioning this, because I've got a story associated with this. So go, okay. Go ahead, this is a good story.
My father was in the wholesale confectionery business. One of his relatives had a retail...
My great-uncle.
Your great-uncle had a... It was more than just a... It was like a spa, they used to call it spas. They had a little fountain, they had a little of this, a little of that. And he sold a little bulk candy and that sort of stuff. And we had a, my dad had a Ginsburg, was another big family in Bangor that you haven't mentioned. I think it was Rosalie Ginsburg was worked for my dad. So his great uncle called up one day, and he had a little bit of an accent.
I'm sure.
And he said, you know, so how much are jelly beans today? Because jelly beans used to come in a 25-pound box, and you doled them out in a little cup. And I don't remember the exact number, but Rosalie said they were 23 cents a pound. So my father had a lovely Irishman working for him. He worked for my dad for 54 years. There's a man you should have had in here years ago, because he was an extraordinary storyteller. I mean extraordinary.
Yes.
Anyway, so he walks in the store, and his grandpa says, so by you, how much is jelly beans? And Jack said, 25 cents. You're a crook, a robber. He says, I call speak Rosalie, it's 23 cents. I'm not going to buy from you anymore. You know, and Jack says, now calm down. He says, wait a minute now. He said, Rosalie said 23 cents. I said 25 cents. You don't like the price. So you and I have a little conversation, and you win. And I back my price down to 23 cents. I said, you've had a good time, I've had a good time, and you get your jelly beans at the right price. So his great uncle looks up at Jack, was a big guy, and he says, smart boy, smart boy. That's one of Jack's favorite stories. He says, from then on, boy, we were big buddies.
See, candy was always bulk in those days.
Yeah, but not packaged. I want to add something. I'm not sure, Elizabeth, whether you're going to ask this question or not, so I don't want to anticipate something you're going to ask, but I think it's important to point out, people who went from there was a transition. I mean, in the oldest generation, they started as peddlers and they ended as peddlers. That's the oldest of at least our ancestors who came here, because of the age at which they came here. They weren't teenagers. They were already 40 or, you know, something like that, and they weren't going to be able to penetrate, you know, the culture and get any further than that. My grandfather came here when he was 16. Learned English, so forth and so on, but he still had no money. He too started as a peddler, but he must have accumulated enough, either borrowed money or whatever, accumulated enough capital, and so that he had a horse, a wagon, and he peddled. But he didn't do it very long. He was down by the Kanduskeag stream one day, and a lumberman who was on a, you know, on what they call a bender, you know, they would come into town on their 2-week break or something and drink all day. So he came up to my grandfather and said, how much do you want for your horse and wagon? And my grandfather said, it's not for sale, because that was his way of making a living. And he says, I want to buy it. How much do you want? So my grandfather came up with what at that time was a preposterous amount of money. And he said, $200. Thinking to himself, this guy's never going to give me $200. The guy has $200 on him. He gives him the $200. The lumberman takes the horse and the wagon and he pushes them into the Kanduskeg stream. Just, that was how he spent his $200. In the meantime, my grandfather had $200 and he was no longer a peddler. Now he took that and he went into business with a cousin of his in a store. You know, they bought enough inventory and they borrowed this and that. And you know, kind of a funny, just like his cousin Edward, who was you know, a tailor who sewed the buttons on wrong, ended up making a fortune in the scrap business.
Can tell you better than I. At one point, my father did peddle. And the interesting was, he said he took a train out of Bangor, I think, to Hudson or someplace.
That was when they already had the confectionery. Hmm? That's when they already had the confectionery. He was just a traveling salesman.
Yeah, but anyway, he peddled with a man named McDonald, who was an immigrant, I believe, and I said,
no.
McDonald had already lived here?
Oh, McDonald was an old family here.
Was it? Okay, but anyways, there was this nice Jew and a nice Irishman peddling together. But then he left and went to Brownville Junction, and Linda can tell you more about how it started and what it was and where he got his money and so forth.
Well, when he went up to Brownville Junction to open up a little store, like, you know, he had a little lunchroom, a little this, a little of that. Brownville Junction was then a big railroad town. Both the CP, I think, and the Canadian National both changed crews there. And
the V&A came up to there.
Yeah, went through that. Was a connecting point. Anyway, as my father tells the story, T.R. Savage, which was a very large wholesale grocery company in Bangor at the time,
and now part of Hannaford.
Hannaford now. The progenitor of Hannaford's. Right.
Right. But anyway, so as my father tells the story, and T.R. Savage himself gave my father $500 worth of credit that he could spend at T.R. Savage. And he says, when you get the $500 back, come back and buy some more. And that's what he opened the store with. And
that was unusual for any man to come up with that kind of money for an immigrant.
Yeah, anyway, it was 1911, I think. I've got the written down someplace, 1911 or 12. I've told that story to Tom Savage, who's the grandson of T.R. Savage. And so that's how that all started.
There was a man, and Leonard, I think he lived on Poplar Street. There was a man who later on, when they got a little better off, worked at Merrill Trust. What was his name?
Oh, I don't remember. Yeah.
Anyways, he was the only one there. He would make small loans to the Jews, $25, $50.
Mr. Russ?
Huh?
Yeah,
Mr.
Harold
Russ.
Harold
Mr.
Russ.
Russ.
Okay. Harold
he lived
Russ.
On Poplar Street.
Poplar
yes,
Street,
he lived
right.
On Poplar Street.
Yeah, I remember
Harold
very
Russ.
Well.
I used to have to deliver a box of chocolate chips.
He shouldn't be forgotten because
Harold
he was
Russ.
The only one in town that would loan a little money. And I suppose the story goes he was willing because he never got stuck. I once knew his grandson who was living in Portland, and I told the story to his grandson, who was exceedingly pleased to hear the story.
There's also the story of the half a dozen Jewish merchants in Pickering Square. A couple of them were in the meat business, a couple of them in the fruit and produce business, and they no one had any money. So one guy would give them a check. He wouldn't cash it, but he'd use that for the next guy. It was called kiting, as I recall.
That's right.
And that check used to go around and around and around. If it ever stopped, they'd all go broke. But the same check had 40 endorsements on the back. Did you hear that story?
Yeah. And later, And I think it's in Sidney Epstein's recording that later on, there was a little more formality to it. They would meet very often in Alan Lewis' clothing store in the back room on a Friday afternoon and see who had written checks that couldn't be covered. And they would help each other out. But every Friday afternoon, so how much debt you got out there, how much money you got, and they would cover themselves and they met every Friday night because none of them, there were more checks out than there was money, and they met Friday afternoon to try to keep them out of trouble.
That I don't remember, but.
Interesting. Well, I think I've been asking about, you were saying how their lives had improved. They had been peddlers and they just kept making their way.
Well,
but
go ahead.
but in what way?
Yeah, well, some of them, I mean, as in every other community where, you know, there's economic expansion and you have entrepreneurial people and so forth and so on, you know, nobody wants to still be digging ditches, so to speak. So, you know, one of the primary things was they have children and those children had to go to college. I mean, I don't know, I can't cite a statistic, but I would say the graduation rate among the children of immigrants was exceptionally high. Yep.
Reason that Jews, more than as much as any other people, during the previous 2,000 years, stressed education. The majority of the people could not read. Jews, or most Jews, could. And there's an old story that the day, and of course, way back, the education was all religious. Right. But the first day that a child was to be educated, you took a drop of honey and put it on the first page. The kid kisses the honey so that his introduction to education is sweet. And George Kerr, whose parents were Polish, just told me the story this week that his father was a carpenter and was very happy to have George grow up and be the third or fourth generation carpenter. And they lived in a community that was basically immigrant, half Jewish and much Polish. And his father said, you know, join me, we'll be carpenters. His mother looked around and saw all the Jewish kids going to colleges and what they were doing. He said, no, you're going to be like the Jewish kids, you're going to go to college.
The generation that didn't go to college, and if they advanced beyond, you know, if they owned stores or whatever, for the most part, I think they did okay. I mean, they were able to borrow funds and, you know, either rent a place, somebody would extend them credits, the story that you told about, you know, T.R. Savage and so forth and so on. And they built businesses, some of them more successful than others. But I think, as Norman mentioned, I mean, there were a lot of people, you know, in the textile business and the shoe business, so forth and so on. But those were the standouts. In between, you had people who owned like the Standard Shoe business and the Boston store and Alan Lewis and Janelle's and there were so many businesses, Cortel Siegel.
Yeah.
The Star Store.
Yeah,
I mean,
Standard Shoe Show in Bangor Shoe was the Shiro family.
Right.
Alan Lewis
was Ralski and Cohen.
Yeah.
You know, Enterprise. You know, the Boston store was Harry Broder.
But he was married to a Cohen.
He was married to a Cohen, which is what put him in business.
Right.
And you know, Enterprise Shoe, he was married to a Cohen. Same thing. The Janelle's, they had the photo business, that was the Rosen family.
Yeah.
And,
Main Street must have had five shoe stores, all except for Kerr and Company Boot Shop. They were all owned by Jews, and Kerr was Irish. But again, it's little stores starting out with nothing.
Jewelry stores, there was Crown Jewelers, yes. Rosen Manhattan Jewelers was Cohen.
Well, your family had a couple of...
There were drugstores. My father had a drugstore. The Miller drugstore.
Eddie Allen had two drugstores.
One downtown and one on Hammond Street.
At one point, he had two directly across the street from each other.
Wow.
One of Exchange Street, Hollow, Exchange Street, State.
So, you know, they were entrepreneurial. They opened up businesses and so forth. I mean, of the earliest immigrant generation, there was one, at least in our family, that was a standout, and that was Simon Cohen. He was one of the sons of our original Alfred Cohen, who came over here. He didn't speak a word of English. He started out by selling matches, literally standing on the street and selling wooden matches. Now, he ended up owning a good chunk of downtown Bangor. He owned where the Caldwell Suite, right now it's called Patty Murphy's. He owned that building. He owned the building next door, which was where the Boston store was. He owned two other buildings down there. He owned ended up buying the Parkhurst Trunk Factory, which is a big trunk manufacturing business that was owned by Frederick Parkhurst, who became the governor of Maine. He was really entrepreneurial. And up the street, he had a big discount store called the New York Syndicate store, which was a Marden's type of operation.
Yeah, right.
He was really, the word was a tycoon. So he was an ambitious guy, and all of his children, well, at least all of his sons went to college, graduated from college. Two of them were lawyers and this and that. And, you know, that's the idea. Education, the next step so you could get into a profession, whether it's a doctor or a lawyer.
I ever discussed with our parents going to college. It was just a given.
Automatic.
It's just automatic. Yeah. I mean, we just knew we were going to college. We didn't have to be talked into it or anything else. It's just what happens next.
What about the women you said, not the daughters?
Well, I can speak at least to my immediate family. I mean, both of my aunts graduated from college. One went to the university, graduated University of Maine. The other one graduated from Radcliffe. And among their first cousins, the Alperts, this is the family that Leonard was speaking of, had the spa on State Street or the confectionery store on State Street. Those girls all went to college. Every one of them went to the University of Maine and graduated. And the Cohen family, that included Pauline Cohen, Sylvia Cohen, May Cohen, Ada Cohen, all those girls went to college. You know, every one of them went to the University of Maine and they all graduated. And so I think and I don't know about the Connors, the Epstein girls, Norman, did those girls, did they go to?
I don't know whether Charlotte, the Connors, James school. Connors, by the way, who was in the furniture business with my father until my father sold out when he got drafted in World War I.
Meyer Epstein's two girls went to college.
Yes, Meyer Epstein's sister was Catherine Connors.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
Their sons all went to college.
Their sons went to college. Sure. Norman
so did Charlotte.
She went to college?
I think so.
Okay. Norman went to Harvard, I think, something. There was a girl named Charlotte. I have no idea whether
Charlotte Glass. Charlotte Glass.
Yeah, but
Connors
I think she
Glass.
Went to, cause I think she was at one time on Colby's board.
So?
No.
I think
no,
the answer
well,
is.
That was Ron's wife.
A good number of them. But I can't speak in terms of, you know, what percentage that representative of the Jewish population of Bangor. I have no idea.
Well, the oddity is that the birth rate was probably 250, 300 families at one point.
Yeah.
Today it's much, much smaller. I do a fund drive in Bangor Brewer, and I don't have more than 120 or 30 houses to go to. Conversely, there are more Jews in the surrounding communities, not all of them. There was a thriving community in Old Town, which no longer exists, but in the smaller towns and there are more Jews than there used to be. The marriage between the Cohen and Epstein families is remarkably limited in view of the fact of their size.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Just Hyman, one that I know of.
No, two. Hyman Cohen's wife was apparently Sarah Cohen.
Hyman Epstein.
Epstein's
wife.
And then, of course, Alpha Saltzman and...
oh, that's right, Mildred. She's
and Mildred Saltzman.
Yeah,
Mildred, her mother was a Kamakovich lady, came in. So she was an Epstein, and then Elma's mother was a Cohen.
Right.
So that those are the only two marriages that I'm aware of, and I didn't even know one of them until Jordan told me about Hyman and Sarah.
The Jewish community also, in all fairness, really, I think, became a lot more prosperous during and after World War II, because some of the shoe manufacturers that were struggling before the war and went through the Depression, all of a sudden they had military contracts.
Well, Leonard, you could say this about everything.
Well, yes,
tremendous, you know, economic
expansion.
But
we're talking about Bangor, because I can remember the demographics. You know, I can. I sold to most of these people at one stage of my selling career. So, but that's, you are right, of course, that was a general, but it certainly affected the Jewish community.
Sure.
Because by that time, that second or third generation of educated kids were available, for one thing. The Viner Brothers Shoe Factory went from the cobbler that Norman mentioned to a rather sizable
production.
We had three Jewish-owned shoe factories in Old Town. So, and two in Bangor, yeah. So, the next generation was, you know, the East generation. The only problem is that the generation that followed us is the one that's disappearing.
Well,
For example, I followed in my, I went into to the family business. My daughter was managing, she was managing our Portland operation. She couldn't stand it. She couldn't wait to get out. And as you look around Bangor, there's very few of my generation that has family here. Very, very few. That's why part of it's dwindled. There is no manufacturing sector here in Bangor anymore. There are some. Your family's got a lot of professionals.
Retail is a thing of the past.
Yeah, not here though. Couple.
You
got three lawyers.
Yeah, you got three.
And Michael.
Lawyers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've only got one. No.
Consider yourself fortunate.
I was going to say I'm ahead of the game, aren't I?
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Yes.
Sorry. So you were saying that it used to go to 200 to 300 families, and now there are only 120 to 300 in the area you go to.
I can't hear the question.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's me. I have a hearing problem.
Sorry. You can't hear me from over there anyway. So you said it went from 200 to 250 to 300 people that you would go to, and now
houses,
no, families. There were 250 families, and now we're down to 125 families.
Wow, that's a steep.
Yes, it's a huge drop.
Wow.
But there are a few more around in small towns. The old town has disappeared, and there was a synagogue in the old town. There was a synagogue which folded many, many years ago. There was a synagogue in Presque Isle, which took care of the people in Aroostook and Andrew. Went into New Brunswick, Fredericton, and so forth.
It was also one in Callis.
That closed at four or five years ago. The one in Callis closed
long ago.
Their artifacts are in resistance, but they're in the Jewish Museum in St. John, New Brunswick. Some of the records of the Aroostook County Hebrew Center are in the Bangor Library, and a couple of things that the, because I represented them when they closed. The Torah came to Bangor. We still have the sign that was over their door, and some of the records we put in the Bangor Library. But that was only 7 or 8 years ago. There's still a synagogue in Rockland and Bath, I think, and Augusta, Waterville. Waterville may share their rabbi with Colby. I'm not certain, but but that's been true of Maine all along. We lose our educated people. That's just not Jews. There's not the economic opportunity in Maine for well-educated, trained people, and it's happening in the general community as well.
Absolutely.
Well, I was going to go into questions maybe about, you know, your childhood, your parents' childhood. Did they ever tell you stories of what their childhoods were like when they...
I think most of them, and I say this kind of wryly, I think most of them were trying to forget their childhoods. They weren't all there. Those that came out of Europe certainly were not particularly fond of.
The ones that came out of Europe basically had no childhood.
Right.
What about the parents? What about your parents? Did they talk about?
We're first generation.
Yeah, their parents were
that's
from
true.
Europe,
that's
from
true.
Russia.
You're second generation.
Yeah. So my dad. Yeah. Well, my mom was from New York, so I'm not going to speak about her. You know, this is not relevant to what your focus is here. Mm-hmm. But as far as he's concerned, or his life is concerned, I mean, he had a very typical American, New England upbringing. I mean, interestingly, first of all, to go back a step. That is my grandfather's family, were the only Jewish family, and Leonard, Norm, you might correct me on this, but I believe they were the only Jewish family on the west side of the city. We're talking about 1920s, 1930s.
Yeah. We'll give you that.
Except for the Rudmans, he had a business over there when he had, before the Pepsi business, he was a Coca-Cola distributor, and he was on Main Street, but I don't think he lived there.
No.
But that was the progenitor to Rudman Beverage, which, you know, was a, anyway. His childhood, I think, was happy, and you know, he was went to public school. He he played ball. He they went to summer camp. They had a camp out in Lucerne. He enjoyed the childhood that I think my grandfather probably would have liked to have had. And we went to religious, my dad went to Hebrew school, whatever, however many days a week that was supposed to be. He had a bar mitzvah. My grandfather had a store, so my dad went to work in the store as a, probably 13 or 14 years old to help out, and as did his sisters. So I would say it was a very typical.
Yeah, but that's misleading, Jordan. It was typical, and ours was typical, and we did all the things that everyone else did. But our friends were all Jewish. You did not mingle. Yeah, we had certain friends in school.
Yeah.
But you did not mingle that much with the Christian community. When I was in school, there was a formal put on by the Sub-Deb Club and the other club that used to be there, and a Jewish club. But the Jews weren't in that club. The Jews had their own club. They had a fraternity. We had Mu Sigma, if you remember.
Mu Sigma, yeah.
Your closest friends, there was a leading citizen of Bangor whose name I will not mention, but you would recognize it. His son told me that. His father said to him, it's all nice and good, but your friend should be of your own kind. And I think there was a sort of a separate but equal attitude on a social basis. And there was a little anti-Semitism from time to time. But it was not, I don't think I suffered in high school. I don't know what Leonard's experience was. I certainly didn't suffer in high school.
You certainly didn't play golf at Penobscot Country.
No, you couldn't play golf. If you look at LaMarche's History of the Eastern Maine, Jewish doctors were not admitted to practice at the hospital, did not get credentials. If a Christian came in, he got admitted, but a Jew came in, he had to wait 5 or 10 years.
What year was this?
There were no Jews on any bank board. There were no Jews on the hospital board. There were no Jews on the library board. It was sort of separate but equal in many ways. They respected you. They did business with you. But they didn't mingle an awful lot socially. I think Jordan's, I bet most of your parents' friends were Jewish.
Well, interestingly, I would disagree with that. I'd say they had a lot of friends who were not Jewish. And I think one of the reasons why, I think there's two reasons, primary reasons why. One is because my dad did grow up on the west side of the city. His friends growing up
that
were primarily
change.
Not Jewish, because that's who the kids he played with were. This was a Catholic neighborhood. St. Mary's was right behind them,
yeah.
And my grandfather had some apartments, so there were tenants who were of Irish Catholic descent. That my dad was good, close friends with those kids, and I keep in touch with their own children at this point, and so I think that he tended to be. Because that was the milieu that he grew up in.
Yes.
And as an adult, they had, I would say, as many Jewish friends as non-Jewish friends. And because my dad had a pharmacy and was friendly with a lot of doctors, and there were a lot of Jewish doctors, but there were a lot of doctors who were not Jewish that they were friends with, like the Longos and the Ferguses, and there were, the Martins, there were all kinds of them. So they maintained, the Elliots, they maintained a balance. Not deliberately, it just evolved that way. Without having any, it didn't have any impact on their sense of Jewish identity. Just, I think, just very modern in their outlook. And they weren't seeking to join the Tarotine Club or the Penobscot Valley Country Club. They wouldn't have been admitted, or some of these other organizations. I know Sidney Chasen told me a story last year, and I wish I could remember the details. And I think you should be interviewing him as well, by the way.
No, I mentioned
he's
that.
He's a very important figure. And he was telling me about when he decided to do his residency in OBGYN and in practice at Eastern Maine. He was told point blank, we don't need you. We don't need it. Why don't you practice something else? And, they sought to keep him out, but they did not prevail. So that was in the 40s, I think.
Jews are sometimes called clannish. And they were. But it wasn't always their choice. They were clannish because
You were forced to rely on your kinsmen who weren't going to say, no, you can't join this club. So what did they do when they couldn't join the Penobscot Valley Country Club? They bought the Lucerne Inn, and they turned it into a, their own, it had a golf course with it and had rights to a beach area because the Lucerne Beach Club was also restricted.
Yeah.
So they bought the club, they bought the, they leased the land down at the beach, and they established their own country club with a golf course.
It was called Pinewood.
Called Pinewood Country Club.
And it was not totally Jewish, but it was probably 60-70%
Oh, yes,
and the only reason
sure.
they bought it was because they were not permitted to play golf anywhere else.
And Bangor Muni didn't exist at that time.
Leonard, what's your... with us? What's your...
I'm not arguing with any of that.
Is there anything you'd like to share about it?
No, I think they've pretty well covered it. You know, there were certain things that it didn't matter whether you were Jewish or not. My mother once was co-chair of March of Dimes or something like that. It was March of Dimes, I guess. She co-chaired it with a minister from Brewer, as a matter of fact. But and my father was a Mason and a Shriner.
There were a lot of Jews
so he wasn't
in the Masons, by the way.
Yeah, but even when I joined, Joe Ornstein was a master, about to be a master, and he admitted that he had to wait to introduce my name until certain people were not present at the meeting.
Yeah, there were some problems. I know another guy that never got in until he moved out.
They were blackballing Jews. But he knew, they pretty much knew, even though it was secret, they pretty much knew who was doing it. And when they weren't there, they would introduce a Jewish name.
Yeah. My father was very active in the Masons when he lived in Bromwell Junction. And those people remained his friends forever. It always, if they ever came down to Bangor, they ended up on Layton Street where we lived. My father used to have to keep a couple of bottles at the ready when they came down.
Well, do any of you know any stories about what your mother's life was like before she married your father? Maybe how they met?
You know a bit about me, and I'll tell you her best story, but go ahead.
We like to think that the best years of our mother's lives were when we were around. I certainly don't know much about
it. Well, you know the story about the convent and the rest of it.
Your mother wasn't one of the ones that went to the convent, I don't believe. My grandfather lived in Montreal. My mother was born in Montreal. Her birth mother died when she was quite young. And they lived next door to a convent. And at least two of my aunts, if not three, there had always been a very close relationship between the mother superior and my grandfather. So when my mother died, that mother superior became almost like a mother to her younger sister.
Partially because of the stepmother.
Huh?
Partially
because of the stepmother. And two of those aunts eventually lived on the west coast of this country. And if they ever came east, which they did on a regular basis, they would very, very often go through Montreal just to visit this mother superior.
No, but when they
until
did
she
meet,
passed away.
But when they did meet the grandfather, they met him outside the house because the stepmother had been the fairy book tale main stepmother.
But my mother was older, was not.
My stepmother, as I told you, she came as a young child, and I mentioned that. And they lived in Chelsea, I believe, under terrible conditions. And at the age of 12, she moved out. And said, I believe my story is correct, she worked 50 to 60 hours at the Hood Rubber Company. And her comment was, we didn't feel underprivileged because at 12 years old, we were working 50 hours. We were the lucky ones that had jobs. And she supported herself. And one of her comments was, well, I had two pair of underwear. They didn't dry quick in those days. So I wore one Monday. It would dry before Wednesday. And then I had the pair to wear Tuesday, which would dry for Thursday. But at 12 years old, she was working full time.
Can I just ask, was your stepmother your biological mother? Is that?
No.
Oh, okay, because you're talking about a stepmother and you're talking about a mother.
I'm talking about my mother, birth mother. He was talking about his
stepmother. I'm talking about my stepmother. May, who was our mother, died in 1938.
Okay.
And my father remarried in, I think, 1941.
40.
And so the one story I told was of the lady he married in 1941.
And her name? Her name was Bess.
Her name was Bess.
Yeah.
And that was one of those very nice marriages, because the sisters of my birth mother became very, very close with our stepmother. It just like as if they had been sisters. Quite unusual.
Do you have any?
Well, my mom didn't, she wasn't from Bangor. She was born and brought up in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So, you know, she came from another world entirely. I mean, she grew up in a neighborhood where everybody spoke Yiddish. I mean, she went to a school initially, I think the first X number of years of school, it was taught in Yiddish. So she really didn't learn English until such and such an age. And so she came from, a pretty sheltered home. And she had a brother who was severely disabled, so there was a lot of focus on him. And she met my dad in the war, and they got married after a brief courtship. And after the war, they came back to Bangor, and her life before was in a giant city in a very tight community, into coming to Bangor, Maine, which was an entirely different experience, but I think she thrived here. So she felt very comfortable here.
One of the funny stories, I think Linda can correct me, is that it was not uncommon if men wanted a weekend in the city that they would go to Montreal as well as Boston. You could go up to Brownville, get the night train into Montreal. One of them went up and met and married, and I think the first one was Phil Kaminsky, maybe.
I don't know.
Of them anyways ended up marrying a Montreal girl. And in the next 18 months, three more Bangor men married three more Montreal ladies. There were four of them in the community that had been friends in Montreal.
Thank you.
I'm noticing we're almost all out of water. Should we pause and refill?
Yeah, I was just thinking we probably need a break because...
That was later. Yeah.
In 1959, I was president of the JCs, and JC sponsored a golf tournament.
Okay.
At that time, it was still a segregated golf course. They never had to face the problem of blacks because there were none, really. But they did. But when I was president of the JCs, sponsoring the organization of this golf tournament, it was still no Jews allowed.
But you have to understand that this is not inconsistent with a lot of other cities. I can talk about Los Angeles, for example. There were major country clubs, the Los Angeles Country Club, for example. If there were a Jewish or a couple Jewish members, they were token members. So the Jewish guys went and formed Hillcrest Country Club. So various cities had the same, in New York, out in, these clubs like the Apawamas Club and some of these clubs in the Westchester County and so forth and so on. But all of that, I mean, the whole playing field has more or less been leveled.
Groucho Marx's one of his most famous remarks was, when he was told he couldn't belong to a certain country club, he said, I wouldn't want to belong to a country club that I was a member of.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I think he had a daughter who was half Jewish, and he said, "Well, if she wants to go in the water and go swimming, which half gets to go in?" You know, same thing. So,
you had mentioned something about how they were lifelong friends, the people I think from Brownville, I think.
No, I mentioned.
You mentioned that they were lifelong friends. Do you think there was less anti-Semitism in a rural area?
Well, certainly among that small group that my father was friendly with, there was no, but that was not the general sentiment, I don't, you know.
Okay.
He's talking about a group that was in Brownville Junction.
Yeah, that's another generation back. But,
One of the Cohens was
very successful in Brownville Junction. This is S.H. Cohen.
Edna's
father. I mean, again, a guy who's very entrepreneurial. He was born in like 1877 or something like that over in Lithuania. Came over here as a young man. He probably started as a peddler. And then he, again, accumulated enough capital. He went in partnership on a clothing store. Anyway, he ended up with two or three stores in Brownville Junction, did really well, came down to Bangor, and retired. And
the initial stained glass windows in the front, and then the biggest ones, there's two on each side.
Yeah.
On the right-hand side, as you know, the two big ones were Mr. Cohen and his wife.
One he presented, in memory of his wife after she died. But, you know, there is Max Cohen also got his start up in that area. And he was a very charismatic figure, and we haven't really spoken about him. He died in 1930, so we're talking about, before our collective time. But his foothold was up there until he came down to Bangor. And he was, again, a guy who broke down a lot of barriers. Even though he came here not knowing any English and so on, he became an advisor to Governor Baxter and Governor Brewster and so forth and so on. He had a store on Exchange Street where he had the infamous smoke-filled back room with various political figures would come in, and he was a stalwart of the main Republican Party. And but he didn't get there by shrinking in a wave or before a wave of anti-Semitism. First of all, I think he must have been very charming, and secondly, charismatic, and secondly, and a very smart guy. And if he encountered anti-Semitism, I guess he knew how to deal with it. So my sense is you guys are a lot older than I am, and I can only speak on behalf of you are, but you know what, you're between my generation and my dad's generation.
Well, quite frankly, we're older than almost everybody.
Yeah. I can speak from my experience, and I can say, when I grew up in Bangor, I did not experience directly any anti-Semitism. I could not cite a single example. And speaking on behalf of my dad could tell me only one or two, things. That he directly, and they weren't even incidents. I mean, the way he would walk to school is he'd make sure he was not walking by St. Mary's because he was afraid, he might, one of those kids who might have been a bully would beat him up for being Jewish. So he avoided that. So he couldn't sit there and say, well, this happened and that happened, because it didn't happen to him.
When I was in school, there was a sub-deb club and another club. They were totally Christian. And then there were equivalent Jewish clubs. And Christian fraternity, and there was a Jewish fraternity. There was a junior league, which was very anti-Semitic, I suspect, but actually Hadassah of a neighbor sponsored a Jewish junior league, and you have clippings of these two. The newspaper didn't apparently differentiate too much, but it was sort of, there was not a lot of overt, but there was still underlying. As I said, it's the old doctrine of separate but equal, but being equal is an accomplishment.
I have one anecdote I'm going to share, and because this goes back to my grandfather's time. So here he was, an immigrant. He started as a peddler, this and that. He accumulated enough capital. He started this business, that business. Nothing worked, and then he started up a store that was a mirror image of his brother's store, which Leonard told the anecdote about the 23 cents a pound for the candy versus the 25 cents a pound for the candy. My grandfather's store was on Main Street. His brother's store was on State Street. But they were what you called confectionery stores in those days. They served ice cream. They poured beer. They had a license to pour beer, but not liquor. They sold cigarettes, cigars, tobacco, candy, etc. And that was it. So my grandfather's store was across the street from the gas works in like the railroad yard. So they had the turntable over there and so forth and so on. And so these guys who worked in the railroad yard, they'd come in after work. They'd sit down at a table. They'd have a beer or two and, buy their cigarettes and this and that. And my grandfather made a good living just doing that. In the meantime, on Sundays, the ladies would come in and they'd have an ice cream and so forth and so on. So one Sunday or Monday, whatever day of the week it was, there was a revival meeting. There was a famous evangelist by the name of Billy Sunday. I don't know if you've ever heard of heard of him, but he was, you know, he'd go out and they'd fill the auditoriums up and he'd go out and give a big speech and get everybody all fired up. So after this revival meeting, these two ladies in their Sunday finest, whatever, in their white gloves and whatever, came into my grandfather's store. They sat down, they ordered their ice creams. He brings the ice cream over, and one of them said to him, Mr. Alpert, you don't know where we've been, do you? And he said, no, ma'am, I don't. She goes, well, we just came from a meeting to hear Billy Sunday. So he said, oh, is that so? And she said, yes. And she said, do you know what Billy Sunday says about the Jews? And he said, no, ma'am, I don't. And she said, Billy Sunday said, all the Jews are going to go to hell. So my grandfather, who had a very quick wit, said, well, they'll soon make a paradise of it. And that was his attitude. And I think that was an attitude that represented a lot of people's, that if you experienced, you know, the negative, you were going to turn it into a positive. And I think most of the Jewish community in Bangor succeeded in doing that. Do you guys agree with that?
Well, I think there was a little more over anti-Semitism, I think, when we were growing up than there was perhaps.
When
you were growing up. Now, you know, when it came to certain civic things, it wasn't so bad. But there again, it was okay, you know. But I certainly remember experiencing it, certainly in grade school, maybe not so much in high school. But I remember I took golf lessons from Charlie Emery, who was the Lord High Master at Penobscot Country Club mm-hmm. for many years, but he had an indoor golf school in the wintertime. So he invited me out to play around the golf with him in the spring, as he did all of his students. And I can remember two or three people, a couple of them who were the stalwarts of Bangor's community today, who one of them came over to me and said, what are you doing here? And, you know, and today he's one of Bangor's finest, but he's probably grown up a little too, I hope. Mm-hmm. Obviously he has.
See, thing on the country club, I mentioned the JC thing, that they were delighted to have the tournament. It's probably the biggest and best ever held in Maine. It's part of that quarter centennial celebration that Bangor had. Bob Toski, who was a PGA player, won many national, won that one. A guy named Champagne Tony Lima sort of adopted me and had me following for a couple of years. Delightfully, he got killed in a plane crash shortly thereafter. Bobby Locke, the famous English, was not a contestant in a sense because he was old, but he came and everyone wanted to see him. And so the country club, knowing all these people were here, had two banquets. I was president of the JCs, I was president of the sponsoring organization. It would be appropriate for the president of the sponsoring organization to be at the banquet, and I was invited. And in both instances, I said, I don't think I can make it. Okay. Not once did they say, you're the president of the sponsoring, or you should be. They actually looked relieved and delighted at both banquets, and I think I'm busy that night.
How did your family spend their evenings together, I've been wondering?
You mean when I was a kid?
Yeah, when you were a kid.
Boy, I don't remember anything unusual happening. I mean, we didn't sit around and watch television, that was for sure. I don't know. I really don't remember that there was anything unusual. I suppose we had a radio, I'm sure. And in the later years, my father liked television. Well, you know, he was semi-retired. But I don't remember anything unusual, you know.
What about?
I suppose I must have done my homework at some time, but you know, in high school, early or junior high school. But you know, this was no television scene where all the happy family sat around the dining room table and exchange pleasantries of the day. I mean, we had meals together. Maybe he remembers something unique about
nothing.
Huh?
Nothing. I don't think that any other family did.
I don't remember.
He sat around, listened to a radio. Kate Smith was on every Friday night. I remember that.
Well, one of the big things when we were kids, we slept in twin beds, and we had a nightstand between us, and we had a radio on there, and the radio was supposed to be off at a certain time, because the little boys are supposed to go to sleep, and we'd turn the radio on just enough so we could hear what was, you know.
And probably the story we shouldn't tell is that in those days, your mattress and your spring sat on slats. I think my father ordered the slats a dozen at a time because my brother and I fought physically, furiously in the bedroom, falling on and off the bed, and we probably went through more slats than you can imagine. And he finally
That's
did
a
buy
true story.
A replacement. He'd buy, I think, at a dozen at a time.
That's a true story.
What about you, Jordan?
I don't think there's anything really unique. I suppose if you watched an episode of Dennis the Menace or one of those shows from the 1950s, it was something like that. I mean, my dad worked a lot. He had a pharmacy, so he worked a lot of hours. And so if we had a family meal, maybe it was twice a week. And often my mom would come home from work, make dinner for us, and then go back and bring dinner down to my dad at his store, because he didn't have anyone necessarily to spell him. That was on the one hand. On the other hand, when he was off, they had very active social lives, and they were out, going out to dinner with their friends or playing bridge or so forth and so on. So I grew up with a combination of a lot of independence on the one hand, and when we had meals together, it was, like out of our town, I suppose, in a way. So,
my father spent a great deal of time on organizational work. A ton of it.
Got a great deal.
What kind of organization?
Well, mostly Jewish organizational work, the Zionist Organization of America, Jewish National Fund.
He was one of the founders in Bangor, B'nai B'rith.
Yeah.
He was a youth advisor to both what was called Young Judea, which was a Zionist youth organization, and AZA, which was the B'nai B'rith youth organization.
He would take 2 weeks off and go up to Rochester County just to raise money.
Yes, that's another whole story. And when before he was married, the Sons and Daughters of Zion, which he led, I think, as the only leader, was the principal social organization in town, which resulted in that Ben Gurion letter you have. He told stories of they would hire a boat to go down the Penobscot. They didn't have the money to pay for it. They just hoped enough people showed up to take the trip that they could pay the boat keeper.
I have a question I have to ask. How long is this session going to last?
However long you want it to.
Because I told my wife I'd be home roughly
you
around 4 o'clock.
Around going.
You could leave early. Or you can
tell it. Well, if I leave, he's leaving. I've got the only car.
The other thing is, possibly, I don't know how much more you even want, but could you come back sometime? We could lend it. If that's what you want, we could do other things.
Who's leaving?
You may have enough.
Well, for a different state soon.
I beg your pardon?
You guys are leaving. Okay. Jordan's leaving.
So we could come back, possibly, but I think Linda's got to get ready.
Well, we're recording. Well, I could come Friday. I don't know if that you probably have plans. I'm off the whole day.
Can't be this Friday.
Yeah, no,
okay.
Not this Friday.
Okay.
Whatever you want. I'm flexible.
I got to change my clothes.
Not terribly physically, but I'm flexible otherwise.
Well, what do you think? I'll ask just a few more questions if you want.
It's up to you. Do you think there's more you want?
Well, if we can just meet later, I can meet with you and Leonard sometime.
Well, Jordan should be involved because he's got a...
Well, I was thinking what was the most important lesson that your parents taught you, you know?
The other thing that Jordan and my brother can do better than I, which might be interesting, is, and you were talking about it the other day with to me about Leonard's memory, going up and down Main Street and who over the Jewish storekeepers and so you got the fabric beyond our families. Mm-hmm. He's already mentioned the Boston store, the shoe stores,
right.
And getting some of that history of that doesn't relate to our families can significantly come from Jordan and Leonard, and I would love to see them do some of it. Because unless you go back into the seed directories and start plowing and say whose name is Jewish.
It was all his family.
Not exactly.
They were. Every one of them was related to you.
Get together and discuss local businesses and that stuff, and they have a memory of it, if they're willing. Jordan says he is. And I
sure. Absolutely.
And I'll make my brother show up.
Make ourselves available based on our travel schedule and so forth. Yeah. Is there one last question you want to ask us in the meantime, or you want to?
Well, I was wondering, what major world event that you saw on the news or heard on the radio had the greatest impact on you?
I couldn't guess.
You don't remember anything?
In our childhood, you mean?
Pearl Harbor.
That's the one I was thinking of, Pearl Harbor. He remembers it, and I remember it.
Pearl Harbor. I was playing in a junior high school dance band. We were at WABI radio station, which was on State Street at that time. And while we were making the radio broadcast, which was live, that's when the ticker tape came in and told us about Pearl Harbor.
And I was at the home of a man named Lewis and Dora Gottlieb. Dora was one of the Canadian ladies. They had a son named Philip who was my age, and I was in his house listening to the radio, which was about 4 feet high, and the announcement came over while Philip and I were listening to the Downing Street Junior High School orchestra that my brother was playing, and that's something to remember.
And I really hate to cut it.
I'm gonna answer this very briefly, and Debbie whispered the Kennedy assassination, but actually, I wasn't even thinking of that. The first thing that came to mind was the Six-Day War in 1967, because this had, I think, a profound effect on the position of Jews in this country and worldwide. And it showed that, that in a very brief period of time, the Jewish nation could defend itself against overwhelming odds. I mean, people were just floored by this. And there was a surge of pride in our heritage and in the universe or international statement that we could fight back, that Jews were not victims, that Jews could defend themselves and resist aggressors and maintain a sovereign nation. And this is had a really profound effect on me at the time.
Well, let's try to meet again and get those two to talk about Main Street.
Yeah.
Yes, so thank you.
Was that last comment by Jordan recorded as well?
Because
that's an important, element in instant in Jewish history.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm going to have you sign something physically, but can I have your permission to archive this and use it as the university, put it in the archives, put it online so we can share it with the community?
I don't know what you said.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you have his permission.
Okay, thank you guys.
Yeah, you have his permission.